On the farms in southern Ontario, where our food is being grown and harvested, people part of Canada's temporary foreign worker program are struggling to stay healthy. They come to Canada to work in the fields and greenhouses that feed us, gone for months at a time, leaving behind their families and their homes. By 2020 terms, we would call them essential, because it's difficult to imagine our agricultural supply chain without them. But they aren't being treated that way. There have been over 800 confirmed cases of COVID-19 among migrant farm workers in Ontario, and as of Monday night, 3 men have died. They are survived by family members, wives, and children. Now that eyes are on these operations, problems in the program are being highlighted, and Ottawa has promised to overhaul the system. So what's causing the outbreak? How do we stop the spread? And if the government is promising to change the program, what will actually bring lasting improvements for the people in it? I'm Stephanie Phillips, and this is The Big Story. Catherine Blaisbaum is a national reporter for The Globe and Mail. Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
Can you tell me, who is Bonifacio Eugenio Romero and how did he die?
So Bonifacio was actually the first migrant farm worker to pass away in Ontario after testing positive for COVID-19. And he was just 31 years old, and he has a wife back home in Puebla. So she's sort of planning his funeral and burial and all of that right now, which is obviously super gutting. So Mr. Eugenio Romero came to Canada in February of this year, and he was employed at a Kingsville pepper farm called Woodside Greenhouses. And he came here, as far as we know, through the temporary foreign worker program, and had been, working at Woodside. And, towards the end of May, he developed a fever, and this was registered at sort of one of the daily temperature checks at the facility. And so the director of human resources there drove him to the local hospital to get tested for COVID. And what ended up happening was Bonifacio was moved into a hotel to self-isolate, and he turned out to have tested positive. And he was checked on every day in person by his employer and, accompanied by a translator, because Bonifacio only spoke Spanish for the most part. And public health officials also monitored him, but they did that by phone. And so, one thing that we've sort of seen is perhaps that should have been done in person, because what happened was that Bonifacio's condition really declined. And over the course of about a week or so, he started to have, trouble breathing. And then it just went really far downhill. And he called for an ambulance on May 30th. And he had actually already passed away before the paramedics arrived, and he was then pronounced dead at the hospital. So he was his family's, sole breadwinner, and is obviously deeply missed by his family back home in Mexico.
Now, we've talked about this before on our show, but for those who don't know, what is the Temporary Foreign Worker Program?
So that's a federal program, and it's kind of an overall name for a broad range of programs that allow foreigners to come to the country temporarily. It's mostly known for, letting employers bring in workers to do jobs that Canadians either don't want to do or aren't trained to do. The agriculture sector specifically employs, I think it's something like 60,000 temporary foreign workers each year. And under this federal program, foreign nationals are allowed to work for a particular employer for a set amount of time. So they're status in the country is very inextricably linked with their status with a particular employer. If they lose their job or fired, right, or quit, they no longer have a right to sort of be in Canada for the most part. Some of them stay here for several months and others are here year round. And one really important thing to know in the context of what we're talking about is that a lot of the time, agri-food employers provide workers with housing as part of their contract.
And I want to get into what that housing looks like and the workers that you spoke to, what they told you about those living situations. But first, can you kind of tell me the extent of the outbreak in Ontario amongst migrant workers? How many workers in Ontario have been infected with COVID-19, according to the count that the Globe did?
Yeah. So Tavia, my colleague who has been my partner on this file, she's been tracking this really closely and been in touch with local public health units, because the issue is that a lot of the times the public health unit in their reporting doesn't typically include necessarily sector numbers or nationality. So she's had to do sort of a lot of poking and prodding to understand where the number is at. And she's managed to determine that there are over 800 cases of COVID-19 among migrant workers on farms in Ontario alone. And there was a really big jump over the weekend, just yesterday, actually reported in Windsor Essex, which is a county sort of right in the middle of the growing region. And there were 96 cases announced yesterday that were tied to a single farm.
Wow. And where are these farms located? You mentioned Windsor, Essex. Are there other, certain kind of hotspots where the outbreaks are taking place?
So a lot of this is happening in southwestern Ontario and southern Ontario generally. So Windsor, Essex, Chatham, Kent. And then there's also been some cases in Haldimand and Norfolk. And we recently learned of an outbreak, a smaller one, but an outbreak nonetheless in the Simcoe area.
Okay.
Near sort of north of Toronto.
And it's understanding that these workers came to Canada with COVID, or they contracted it here?
So this is something that we wanted to understand right from the beginning, and is an important question, particularly as it relates to like public perception of these people, because a lot of them have actually faced racism in the towns when they go to get their groceries or, gas stations. The bottom line is that local, provincial, and federal public health officials have emphasized that for the most part, workers arrived in Canada healthy, quarantined, and then contracted the virus locally. We don't know a lot about how they ended up contracting the virus locally, but the assumption, I think, would be that, they became infected after interacting with locals who work on the farm, or when they, went into town to get groceries or something.
Okay. And what happens to a worker if they test positive?
So this is an interesting question, because there's been a development as of last week. Right. So I'll just sort of walk you through before then and after then, because it's actually quite interesting, the evolution of how that looks. So before the Ontario government announced new guidelines last week, a worker would have been isolated, and that could be on a farm or in a hotel or in a bunkhouse, alone, regardless of whether he or she was symptomatic. On Wednesday, though, the Ford government announced guidance for asymptomatic workers who test positive. So the guidelines now say that they can continue working under certain conditions, including that they're basically cohorted with other asymptomatic positives and stay away from those who test negative. And that cohorting applies to both the workplace, so out in the fields, in the greenhouses, and in terms of living arrangements. So this is a really recent development, and it's been quite controversial. There are public health experts, epidemiologists, and lawyers who say that it's not only dangerous, but that it's discriminatory against an already vulnerable population. So just to be clear, this guidance doesn't apply strictly to farm workers. It applies to other sectors as well. So if you're working outside or have minimal interaction with others, maybe you're a park ranger or you're a night shift security guard, you can also work while asymptomatic and positive. But the effect is that this really applies to migrant farm workers. This guidance was released pretty much with the goal of incentivizing employers to participate in mass testing. They had been reluctant before then to do so, because they were worried that a bunch of, quote unquote, healthy workers would, either contract the virus by going to a testing center, or that they would have a bunch of asymptomatic positives who would now come back as positive and they'd lose their entire workforce and their crops would rot.
Interesting. And before this, like, what were their options for getting tested before the new regulations?
So basically, for a while, migrant farm workers just weren't really getting tested. But then these outbreaks kept happening and they kept ramping up. And the province and region knew that they needed to really boost their swabbing effort. So what they did initially, and this was sort of in the wake of Bonifacio Eugenio Romero's death, pretty quickly after that, the Erie Shores Healthcare Hospital in Leamington partnered with some regional players, and they opened a mass testing and assessment center where workers could go to get tested. So workers would be bused in from farms in the areas around Leamington, and they would do so with precautions, whether they're wearing, well, they'd all be wearing masks, and they, the buses were seated at half capacity. So there were a few issues with that. They had wanted to test something like 8,000 workers. They ended up testing less than 1,000. And so the sort of lower than expected uptake is attributed to a few things. Employers were a bit reluctant to participate because they didn't want to lose their workforce to isolation, like I said. And they were also worried that healthy workers might get the virus on the bus or at the center. And then there's also the layer of, you know, these workers are, you know, some of them were apprehensive to travel because they were also worried about being exposed. And they also, for the most part, aren't paid during isolation. And so there's a fear among people who came to Canada to make money that they were going to end up having to isolate and they wouldn't get paid during that isolation period.
So there's a lot of reasons to not kind of want to get tested, right?
Yeah. So what the province has done now is they've launched mobile testing units. So these mobile units will go from farm to farm as long as the employer is willing to have them on the property. It's a slower process because doing a pop-up COVID testing center, you know, takes more resources and time than one might think. So they're bolstering that with continued use of the centralized assessment location.
Before these developments, like what regulations were initially put in place to try to prevent an outbreak like this from happening? And can you tell me why that plan failed?
So there's a few things that we sort of have learned through our reporting on this. It took a while to sort of piece it together, but the bottom line is that, you know, everybody was sort of busy dealing with long-term care and what was going on at hospitals at the outset. And this population really fell through the cracks. And the reality of what life looks like as a migrant worker on a farm just really kind of wasn't taken into account at various levels of government. It was one of those situations where everybody was responsible and so nobody was. So I can just sort of walk you through that a little bit in terms of who was doing what and who should have been doing more.
Okay.
So in terms of what was done, the federal government manages the temporary foreign worker program. Full stop, it's their responsibility. They rolled out a mandatory isolation period for international arrivals. And that requirement said that employers had to pay workers even though they weren't working. Federal guidance also said that beds in bunkhouses should be 6 feet apart, but there was no limit on how many people per bathroom, for example, or how many people per kitchen or per fridge. And then there was also provincial guidance, which applies to workplaces, but not housing, that basically said, you know, if the risk of COVID couldn't be adequately reduced by other methods, then maybe you should use PPE, but it wasn't necessarily a requirement.
Okay.
And then employers were also supposed to alert local public health officials if a worker developed symptoms. And there were also isolation guidelines once a worker tested positive. In addition, the federal and provincial governments provided employers with money to get PPE and modify spaces to better facilitate physical distancing. And then at the hyper-local level, the local public health units do inspections of housing before the workers arrive. But they do that before there's actually any bodies in the housing. So it's kind of hard to get a sense for how people actually move through it and to maybe people weren't totally aware of what this was going to look like once people moved in.
So why didn't that initial plan work? Because they weren't able to social distance in those living quarters?
The main reason that we're hearing from public health experts and from doctors on the ground is that the congregate living situation is a real problem. And that what happened after the 14-day quarantine was a massive blind spot. So sure, the workers came to Canada healthy and they quarantined, but then they go out into the fields or the greenhouse, they work alongside other people, they go into town to get groceries. You know, they're being super safe, but as anyone, you know, somebody contracts it and then it just spreads like wildfire in the bunkhouses because they share bathrooms and kitchens and they literally climb on top of one another to get into bed.
Right.
So as one like migrant worker put it, conditions in farm accommodations were like a recipe for COVID to spread like wildfire. And so rules were rolled out, but they weren't adequately enforced and they just didn't take into account what life in a bunkhouse looks like. And in addition to that, at a time when inspections should have been increased, they actually declined for the most part. So they were either foregone altogether or they were done remotely. And a key thing here is that no employers have so far been found in breach of the temporary foreign worker program's COVID-19 requirements.
Okay. So can you tell me more about how the workers you spoke to described the living conditions? Like you mentioned a few things, but can you kind of walk us through what a bunkhouse might look like?
Sure. So effectively, there's a huge range in what we heard. So in some cases, you know, we spoke with workers who said the bunkhouses were quite nice. They were new. There was the opportunity to social, to physical distance. You know, the toilets were in working order. There were enough sinks for everybody and they felt safe. However, we spoke with lots of workers who said the opposite. And between these interviews and photos and videos that we've obtained from inside bunkhouses, the accounts basically portrayed some overrun bunkhouses with like broken toilets, malfunctioning stoves, cockroach and bed bug infestations, and holes in the ceiling. Mm-hmm. A big issue is, you know, just how closely these people are together. In some cases, people were putting up cardboard boxes and sheets kind of, you know, around their personal space, trying to protect themselves as best they could, at least in that small space that they had in the bunk bed. But, you know, there's also instances where people had, you know, no place to put their belongings. The fridge didn't work. They had nowhere to put their food. So beyond the COVID-19 concerns, there were also just, you know, basic living requirement concerns.
Yeah. Like that. It's hard. It's almost hard to imagine. And I would encourage people to go and look at the photos that you have in your articles on the Globe website. What do the owners and operators of these farms have to say about these described conditions and these photos and videos?
So we've spoken with a few employers, including where Bonifacio worked and where the latest migrant worker to pass away worked. His name was Juan Lopez Chaparro, and he was 55. So Mr. Eugenio Romero's employer was Woodside Greenhouses, and I spoke with somebody there who actually spent a lot of time with Bonifacio and was checking on him every day at the hotel where he was isolating. Hmm. And this man told me that, you know, the bunkhouse that Bonifacio was living in passed public health inspections and was approved for 32 people and housed closer to 20. It had, you know, a big bathroom with 4 toilets, 2 urinals, 4 showers, and 8 sinks. So he was sort of trying to paint the picture of, you know, it was approved. And even after Bonifacio died, public health inspectors and I think the Ministry of Labor went back to look at it and didn't provide them with any, you know, requirements to update it or to make the living situation safer. In this case, the company did say that it provided masks and sanitizer and also circulated coronavirus communications in 3 languages, including in Spanish, as early as kind of March. But then my colleague Tavia, she spoke with the head of Scotland Group, and this is a produce farm in Victoria where Lopez Chaparro Juan worked. And there are nearly 200 cases there out of the something like 215 migrant farm workers who work there. So it's a really big outbreak. And I'm not sure if it still is, but it was as recently as last week, Ontario's largest outbreak. Mm-hmm. And so pretty much all the migrant workers there are infected. Tavia spoke with 3 Scotland workers. All of them tested positive. They described, you know, overcrowded living conditions, all the things that I sort of spoke about earlier, including ill workers living with healthy ones and, you know, absence of information on how to access healthcare, no PPE to guard against the virus, supervisors pressuring them to work when people were clearly falling sick. And so this is all sort of leading up to what did the employer say? So Scott Biddle, the president and CEO of Scotland Group, told Tavia that the firm's accommodations are well above standards and that the farm equipped workers with masks and gloves and that supervisors did not press employees to work with symptoms. He basically said there would be no advantage to them to not take care of a sick worker because, you know, employers need these workers in order to tend to their crops. And so he sort of was making the point that they did everything right and above board.
So if they're doing everything right and above board according to the standards, but, you know, there's still an outbreak going on and people are still getting sick and dying, what are advocates saying needs to happen to stop the spread and prevent another outbreak or prevent something else from happening in the future?
So there's a few things. I think there's sort of the short-term needs and desires, and then there's the long-term needs and desires. So in the short term, advocates are looking for more inspections and enforcement of existing rules. They want bad employers shut down, even temporarily. And they want these workers to get paid sick leave so that workers feel comfortable getting tested and being honest about symptoms. Mm-hmm. In the long term, they're calling for a national housing standard for migrant farm workers, which would effectively sort of, yeah, standardize accommodations across the country when it comes to provide the provision of housing under the temporary foreign worker program. They also want greater access to open work permits and pathways to permanent residency. So open work permits are really interesting. It's one thing that kind of helps a vulnerable worker to leave an abusive employer. So effectively what they can do is, if they have concerns, including COVID-19 related concerns, they can apply to the Federal Immigration Department to leave the bad employer and have an open work permit to work anywhere in the sector for a year. And so I've actually spoken with some people who have made these open work permit applications, and they've been granted them and have since moved on to what they describe as safer employment opportunities. So those are sort of the short and long-term issues. One really big thing that people are calling for is more pathways to permanent residency, so that these workers, you know, have just more rights. They have more power in a system that is currently very much tipped towards the employers in their eyes. The Canadian government has, you know, done or says they're going to do a lot. So we'll have to sort of keep an eye. The employment minister has spoken quite forcefully about this and is saying that nothing is off the table and that she's, you know, planning to overhaul the temporary foreign worker program and, you know, has said, you know, the buck stops with her, even though this is a jurisdictional quagmire.
Okay, we'll have to see what happens. Thanks, Catherine.
Indeed, we'll watch closely. Thank you. Bye, Stephanie.
Catherine Blaisbaum is a national reporter for the Globe and Mail. And that was The Big Story. For more from us, you can visit our website, thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can also follow along on Twitter, @TheBigStoryFPN. And now you can write to us. The email address is thebigstorypodcast@rci.rogers.com. So let us know what you think. I'm Stephanie Phillips. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you on Thursday.